Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today I will be speaking with Donna J. Drucker, a guest professor at Darmstadt Technical University in Germany. Her book, The Classification of Sex, Alfred Kinsey in the Organization of Knowledge, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press, is an in-depth and detailed study of his scientific approach. The book examines Kinsey's career and method of gathering vast amounts of data, identifying patterns and interpretation that was critical to his most influential works, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male and Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. Beginning with Kinsey's study of the animal world, she examines how he transferred natural science methods to sex education in his marriage course at Indiana University, and ultimately to the intense and massive study of human sexual behavior. He brought into the interdisciplinary science of sexology a thoroughly naturalistic approach and believed that taxonomy, collecting, classifying, and describing patterns revealed truths about the natural world and worked against what he considered the prejudice of misclassification. Kinsey was committed to scientific objectivity, free of moral judgment. He believed possible, through unprejudiced observation, the recording of mass data sets and the application of biometrics. Nevertheless, Kinsey's sex research has significant implications for understanding sexual differences between men and women, sexual preference tied to economic class, and the consideration of normal sexual behavior against standing societal norms. Drucker's work brings attention to the historical contingency of the social and technological process by which information is produced and encoded, allowing it to be relayed over time. Drucker's close attention to method and the role of data-gathering technology again raises the question regarding the role of scientific practice in values formation. Here's my conversation with Donna Drucker. Now let me introduce you to the author, Donna Drucker. Hello, Donna.
Hello, Lillian. Thanks for having me on the program.
Welcome to the show, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. Your book is a fascinating study of Kinsey's research methods. So first, before we get into the book, I want you to know, you tell the audience something about yourself, your background, and how you came to write the book, The Classification of Sex.
Sure. I was a graduate student at Indiana University, and when I was looking for a PhD project, I wanted a project that would bring together both history and my background in library science, since I also have a master's of library science. And in 2003, the Kinsey Institute celebrated the 50th anniversary of Kinsey's book on women, sexual behavior, and the human female. And there was a very large conference bringing in scholars from around the world who studied women's sexuality. So I became very deeply involved in that conference, and I also was taking a class from the professor who became my advisor, Judith Allen, and she taught a class on the history of sex research. And I first began to dig into Kinsey's work on gall wasps in his biology textbooks. And the research question came to mind that many people ask me nowadays, how does somebody get from studying something as inconsequential as a gall wasp, or seemingly inconsequential, to the study of human sexuality? And that question just took a hold of me in 2003 when I began this work, and I've been thinking about it ever since.
These are interesting questions, and the way you lay out your study really progresses through how he started with natural sciences and ended up with human sexuality. So what are the main arguments of your book? What is the main thing you're bringing to the table?
The main thing I'm bringing to the table is a focus on classification as an organizing principle for Kinsey's scholarship throughout his life. That was when I was reading all of Kinsey's materials, all of his gall wasp material, his high school textbooks, his teaching material, his work on the marriage course at Indiana University, and then the male and female volumes. What was striking to me is that Kinsey was always interested in gathering as much data as he could, in organizing it, and then in displaying it. He went through those three steps with any body of knowledge that he came across. And I realized that those patterns of classification were what linked his natural history with his human studies.
What was his philosophy of science. He had a very distinct philosophy of science.
Yes. He believed that the best science was available to the human eye through naked eye observation, simply the idea that you could only gather science through what a human being could see. That he thought microscopes were all right for gall wasps, but he really didn't believe in psychology or any science that attributed any characteristics to something that was not actually observable.
So he was a behavioralist with animals.
I don't know exactly. I don't know if I would use that term exactly, but he enjoyed collecting insects in the field, inbreeding them once he returned to his home laboratories, and in studying them and organizing them after they died.
Now, he went into sexology. What was the state of sexology at the time when he was making this transition? What was it? What was the field like before Kinsey?
Well, he was his primary influence, or one of his primary influences, was a man named Robert Lotow Dickinson, who was a Brooklyn-based OBGYN. And Kinsey had gotten in touch with him about some sexual techniques that that Dickinson had published about in a book called Human Sex Anatomy. And he really appreciated Dickinson's ability to use observation over time of women's bodies internally and externally to gather information about their sexuality. Dickinson was fairly well known in the United States. Of course, the dominant understanding of human sexuality at the time was, of course, Freudian and Jungian, which, of course, is not a drastically different direction of studying sexual behavior and desire and emotion than Kinsey took. So he was challenging a rather dominant paradigm that focused on the mind rather than on the body.
So how did he make the transition? A lot of your story is about him making this transition, and it was fascinating to me how he did that, starting with that marriage course at Indiana University. Talk about that, those early years.
Yeah, sure. He was interested in sexuality as an individual, you know, from the time he got married, or at least from the time he got engaged on forward, or perhaps earlier. But for sexual behavior and sexuality as intellectual concepts, he really became interested in that in the late 1920s and early 1930s, when he was teaching a biology pedagogy class to Indiana University students who would become biology teachers in the future. And he realized that they needed some instruction about how to teach young people human sexual physiology, among other types of human physiology, in a way that didn't have a religious overtone, that didn't have a moral overtone, that was just purely descriptive. And he starts teaching human sexual physiology in his college classes, which we know because he kept teaching notes and final exam notes in which he asked the students to design a lesson about teaching young high school and junior high students about sexual behavior. And after he starts incorporating some sex-related material into his teaching, he starts a faculty reading group. He starts reading as much as he can about sex education for young people. He becomes involved in some programs on a statewide level. And he finally meets with, and word of this, his interest starts to get around campus. It wasn't that big of a place. And in late 1937, early 1938, a group of students approach him about teaching a non-credit marriage course. And so he, of course, is very excited by this and starts organizing a faculty team to teach the courses over a summer. They start in the summer of 1938. And they involve questions of marriage from a sociological from a sociological perspective, from a legal perspective, from a medical perspective, but also from a physiological perspective. And those lectures, all of whose texts still exist at the Kinsey Institute, so you can really track how they change over time. Word of those lectures, again, gets around the campus pretty quickly. And at first, the marriage course is restricted to married or engaged students and faculty. But slowly, the course gets larger, and there's a kind of telling scene in the Kinsey movie where students try to pretend they're engaged just to get in the class, and the course takes off like wildfire around campus. And finally, the president of the university gets pressure from local clergy and some parents, and he tells Kinsey, you need to either hand the marriage course over to the medical school or to the medical faculty in Bloomington, or you need to give up the marriage course and pursue this research full time. And Kinsey, of course, starts to pursue the research in earnest full time. That's him.
Now he sees these students are coming and become for him part of his research. He's interviewing these students. I thought that was all very interesting that they would be willing to talk to him and that he would get honest information from them.
Yeah, how he frames it and how students frame it, students who were interviewed much later frame it, is that he basically at first tells students, you know, he is open to them coming to his office for, you know, what he calls like private consultations or private conversations. And as these start to happen, he realizes, being, you know, the scientist and collector that he is, that these students are all sources of data. And so he starts to create a form in which he can record what students are telling him. And as far as we know, that from both his side and from the former student's side, that they were telling the truth or pretty close to it.
Okay, so as he's gathering this data, this becomes a huge project. Talk about how it becomes way more than just this class or just a few students, and much of other people get involved also.
Yes. The marriage course ends around September of 1940, and Kinsey is already thinking much, much bigger. He starts to think, I want to get the personal sexual histories of 100,000 Americans. That's his goal. And he gets money from the Rockefeller Foundation kind of through another avenue. So the Rockefeller Foundation doesn't really want their name attached to him right away because they're not sure the direction the research is going. And so he's getting funding, outside funding, for his work. And he starts to hire a team, and the team has to be completely on board with, you know, his beliefs about sexuality, and he just starts making contacts within any communities that are willing to listen. And he starts to collect using a method akin to snowball sampling, which he calls 100% group sampling, which is where he and his team go to like a Lions Club or like a women's group, and he goes to the leader of the group and he says, I'd like to collect 100% of the histories from your group. And he goes and gives a talk, and all of the group members need to agree to participate in the study. And then he and or one of his team members will interview each of the men or women, or in some cases children, individually. If they were child interviews, they were accompanied by parents. So he starts doing the snowball survey. His contacts start spreading. Word gets out that, you know, this scientist from Indiana, you know, is coming to New York City and wants to interview, you know, a certain number of hotel managers or dentists or any particular professional group. and people just start coming to him. And he collects most of the histories from Indiana, Chicago, New York City, and Philadelphia. But he tries to get some histories from all over the country.
It just that was astounding to me that people would at that time, I mean, this is what, 1930s, 40s?
Mm-hmm.
Were that willing to talk to a stranger about the most private aspects of their lives.
Yeah, it's the material in the mail volume especially kind of describes some aspects of the interview technique and gives some hints at why people were so willing to reveal their private lives to a virtual stranger or a total stranger, in that the questions start out very non-intimate, like how old are you, are you married, do you have children, you know, where are your parents from, and so on. And then the questions build up about childhood, and then they get into adulthood. And the burden of denial was always on the individual. So if someone was never asked, you know, have you ever masturbated, for example, they would only be asked, when was the last time you masturbated? So the burden of denial was always on the individual. And if he or one of the other team members thought somebody was lying, there were several cross-checks within the interview. And if somebody was lying about one thing, it would usually come out in some other part of the interview. So, and I think Kinsey was really, really personable. He really kind of enjoyed people. He enjoyed the gathering of data and information. He enjoyed, you know, kind of being introduced to a sexual world that he had no idea about. And that kind of interest in people as, or people's experiences as scientific objects really pushed him forward.
Now, how many interviews did he end up gathering? I mean, what was the sample for his two books, you know, human sexuality books? Behavior, actually with sexual behavior, because he didn't use the word sexuality, which you talked about, which I'd like to know more about that.
Yeah, sure. Over the entire project, he and his team collected slightly over 18,000 interviews, or interviews from 18,000 individuals. The number of interviews per book was just over 5,000. For the men's book, there were interviews from men who were in prison, but for the women's book, there were not.
Now, what came to mind when I was reading about the massive amount of data and then how they had to sort this data using punch card systems that you talk
mm-hmm.
about, so he had to have the technology to process it.
Right.
What was brought to mind with me was the idea that today we're talking about big data.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, this is big data, the beginning of big data. Or can you make the connection there?
Yeah, I think, as I argue in the book, the project would not have been possible without adopting punch card machines to sort and analyze the research material. It just simply would not have worked to calculate all the data by hand. For each individual interviewee, the team collected at least 350 individual pieces of data. For people who had very complicated histories, the form went up to over 500 questions. And if you multiply that by even, you know, 1,000, you know, you've got a lot of data on your hands. And so Kinsey saw the necessity of punched card machine technology to make sense and order all of that data, for sure.
So his attitude towards this data, he was really committed to scientific inquiry as an objective, free of moral judgment, which today we're very suspicious of that claim, right? We're like, sure, because he believed that he could do this with an unprejudiced mind and record this mass data sets and just sort of apply biometrics and just come up with the truth.
Right. So he claims to be as objective as possible. And there's a line in the female volume, I forget, about two-thirds of the way in, that says something like, we know that we have some biases according to this data that people later on will probably figure out, but we are doing the best we can with this. And of course, you know, a lot of Kinsey's critics and even Kinsey's supporters say, well, you know, he is not a neutral objective observer because he puts all types of sexual behavior on the same moral plane. And in doing so, that is a moral judgment. And Kinsey in the female volume says, yes, I'm aware that I have to make some kind of value judgments on these lines, but my method of making value judgments is much more free and open to the diversity of human behavior than most other systems.
So in a sort of a very sort of scientific way, he's undermining a lot of standing ideas about human sexuality or human behavior. Again, I just said the word sexuality, and I remind myself he did not use that word. So please talk to me about that before you answer the other question.
Yeah, it's sexuality as a term is not something that he uses very, very often. He really wants to stick to observations of behavior and the relationship between behavior and different types of identity categories. And he reserves the word sexuality for a very few instances in the book on women where what he's studying, put in one case, it's nocturnal sex dreams, where though the what is actually happening in the physiology of the body and in the mind is beyond his grasp. And so he deliberately doesn't use a term that he very often that he doesn't fully define or fully understand. Okay. So in a way, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So it does say is he saying that sexuality, because it's basically in the mind, and that's not what he's about. He's about behavior.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about his work is that he actually never completely defines the term sexuality. But he uses it when he's talking about the behavior, the thoughts, the experiences of people that are slightly beyond his grasp, like why people have nocturnal sex dreams at all. Why is that? Why do women have them? When women have them, there's only a few women that usually have them, but the ones who have them have tons of them. And they often have nothing to do with the woman's behavior when she's awake. So he uses sexuality as a term to express when he's kind of at a point of inability to kind of proceed further with thinking about a topic.
Does he define sexual behavior? Because what is a sexual behavior? I mean, you know, scratching your head, is that a sexual behavior? I mean, what is...
In general, he uses it for the specific behaviors that he outlines in the male and female volumes. Nocturnal emissions or sex dreams, masturbation, what he calls petting, which nowadays we would call foreplay, petting to orgasm, premarital intercourse, marital intercourse, extramarital intercourse, intercourse with animals.
Yeah. It's very specific. He doesn't have a really broad definition of what would be included, because in those definitions, he could be excluding other things that could be defined as sexual behavior. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, he does, for each of those behaviors, the only way he counts them is if the individual had an orgasm.
Okay.
For each of those behaviors. So someone, and he actually, you know, says, especially in the female volume, that many people have all kinds of sex-related behavior that doesn't bring them to orgasm. But that kind of behavior is not counted in the volumes, although he's aware of it, obviously. It's just to make the counting easier because if you counted sort of things that just turns you on and the difference between that and orgasm, it just gets even more complicated.
Okay, so what are his ideas about moral values? His research is kind of undoing things. Is he changing also his ideas of what is should be considered acceptable, appropriate in society by his work? Is his work, is he influencing the work and the work is influencing him and how he's changing about how he views sexual behavior that's acceptable against societal norms?
It's a little hard to tell sometimes. Like, he clearly intends the book to be a report on his data and on his findings. And he makes a very clear distinction between original research and applied research. He knows that other people are going to apply what he's found to their own work, whether they're in the legal profession, the medical profession, in psychology, almost any in schools, anything like that. But he really, in the books, tries to draw a very particular line between original research and applied research. In the male volume, he does have these, what he calls tables of kind of standard behaviors for example, like a 25-year-old Jewish man who's been married once and has a college education. And so a clinician could go back to these tables and be like, oh, you know, this kind of person has about, you know, masturbates twice a week, has intercourse twice a week, and then has maybe one nocturnal sex dream or something like that. So he includes these clinical tables so that clinicians like psychiatrists and psychologists can use them to help patients kind of figure out if they're having kind of a normal amount of behavior or not. But in general, he is not intending, he's not seeking applied methods, or he's not seeking applied research.
Now, some of the things that he came up with in his findings of all these thousands of people was, that I found the most interesting, was the racial class differences and the differences or not no difference between men and women in sexual behavior. We hear a lot about his findings on homosexuality, but the race and class and men and women, I think that that is very interesting. If you talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, he does not, he restricts the, just to talk about race first, he talks about, in the male volume, he has great plans to do a huge series of books, including a book specifically on African Americans. He'd like to do a book on Asians, but he passes away before more than the male and female volume are able to be published. So he collects data from non-white populations, but it's never been published. But here and there in the male and female volumes, he does say, well, the class differences among Americans seem to be much stronger than racial differences, which I find, and he, I think, is referring to mostly African Americans, but also to Native Americans at that point. So the race data is available, but it's just never been published. And in terms of social class data, he finds in the male volume that men's social class and the social class of their parents, men's parents, matters quite a bit in terms of the kinds of behavior that they engage in. He has a lot of admiration, open admiration for men who are generally less educated. He usually uses education as a measurement of class, of social class, or as a handy kind of rule of thumb. And he has a great admiration for young men who are generally less than high school or only high school college educated, who go out and seek as much sex as they possibly can get, whether they're married or not. And he admires their kind of freedom and kind of self-expression, I guess you could say. And he has a lot of caustic words for upper-class white Americans who really restrict their who really restrict their own behavior and the behavior of their children in the name of marriage. And he thinks that the reason why upper-class white Americans engage in these so-called petting behaviors so much is because they're so afraid of kind of what will happen if they have sex before marriage, not in terms of getting pregnant necessarily, but in terms of kind of social condemnation. And, of course, Kinsey himself was more of a member of the upper class than he was of the lower class, so he's also kind of implicating his own upbringing in that scenario. But in general, he finds that social class did not have as much impact on women's sexual behavior, and it's not entirely clear why that would be. So he thinks that women are more influenced by their parents than they are by their peers in terms of social class, which doesn't totally add up.
Okay, so he's really kind of railing against middle class values at the at his time, right? How was his work received? Was this a brand new approach to sexuality, but sexual behavior? Yeah. It wasn't psychological. It wasn't philosophical. It wasn't theological. It was very much grounded in biology.
Definitely. It was a very new approach to thinking about human sexual behavior and the position of sexual behavior in American culture. The male volume came out first, and it was published the first week of January 1948. It was put out by a medical publisher. And as it started to get reviewed in all kinds of publications, from major newspapers to minor newspapers to medical journals to sociological journals, pretty much everybody wanted to get their hands on it. It just became a landmark in American culture and thinking about private lives and the public lives of Americans. It generated all kinds of attraction and interest toward Indiana University, towards Kinsey himself, and he restricted the press's access to it at first, and he was very reluctant to give interviews, which of course just made any interview he gave or anything he said even more weight. And so he was good at managing the publicity for the projects as well. So the book set off a real landmine, not a landmine, that's too strong a word. It was a real landmark for people, academics across disciplines. It was a landmark for the legal profession, for sociology, for physiology, for OBGYNs, for pretty much anybody who had an interest in sexuality, which is pretty much anybody out there. So the book on women was received differently, though.
How was it received differently? Was it that they were prepared for it by the previous book, or was it because it was women?
A little bit of both. The male volume had statistics such as, probably six men, or about 10% of the American population, was homosexual. About half of all men cheated on their wives if they were married. Most men had some kind of premarital sex or petting. And the book was published so soon after the Second World War, that the kind of science that Kinsey did was seen as being a sort of triumph of American-style democracy, American scientific inquiry, the freedom, the information, and the science that an American democratic culture could produce. The book on women came out in 1953, and even though it's only 5 years later, there's a very different political culture and social culture into which it enters. And the female volume also includes material like lots of women had extramarital affairs. Women were masturbating. Women were having sex with women and living as lesbians. And the American political culture had turned to the right, And it was a time where, of course, the McCarthy hearings were just beginning to start. Global concerns about communism were on the rise. And nobody was in the mood to hear that women were home masturbating all the time. And so as a result of the publication, Kinsey ends up losing his funding, and he dies just about 3 years later, basically, from overwork and stress from trying to raise the money to produce his next book.
Now, on this scale, this homosexual scale, I think he had a one, what was it, 0 to 6 scale? So when we say that he decided or he concluded that 10% of males were homosexual, that seems like a fixed number versus a scale of 0 to 6. So that seems more fluid, more like people are on a continuum. When he meant 10% means 10% were fully on one side of the scale.
I should have been more clear about that. He found that approximately 10% of men had been exclusively homosexual for about 3 years. And he actually does not like the word homosexual as a way of describing people. He likes it as a way of describing acts. And his idea with the 0 to 6 scale was that the 0 to 6 scale would replace a homosexual heterosexual binary that had done a lot of damage to people coded as homosexual, even if they maybe just had one same-sex encounter. And so he found, I think, that about 47% of men had some kind of homosexual experience to orgasm at some point in their lives, for example. And he thinks, you know, just using the word homosexual to discover as an umbrella term for all that behavior just didn't make any sense, that a scale would make more sense.
That the fluidity that I think many people now would embrace was there.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yes.
A lot of his methods. I mean, I know that people were maybe shocked or comforted, whatever, by his results, his interpretation of the data. But what about the method that he used? How was that received by scientists who would understand it? Statistical methods, you know, he's using biometrics, that sort of his whole process. Was that criticized, and what are the problems with his methods?
He gets criticized for and praised for each of his different methods. In terms of collecting, he gets criticized for oversampling people from the upper Midwest, for oversampling a white population, and in the male volume 4, including prisoners in his sample, because no one wanted to think that prisoners had any similarities to non-prison populations. He gets also criticized for focusing to some extent on urban areas, which many people believed had more homosexual individuals and populations than other places. So he gets criticized for that. He also gets criticized for, in the male volume, for the material on social class, because he argues in one chapter that a man's sexual behavior will predict into which social class he goes when he becomes an adult. And when the American Statistical Association reviewed his facts and his methods, they really attacked that particular set of findings, that there was no causation in that area.
That seemed kind of an odd conclusion to me also, that what the sexual behavior in adolescence would determine the social class that young man would go into, even though it was not the social class of his parents.
Yeah, that math just didn't add.
But the most important part of your work, lots of people have done work on Kinsey, and we, and in the popular imagination out in the public, you know, it's all the really sexy stuff that people have been interested in, and also his private life and his own personal sexual characteristics and behaviors that we have focused in on. But you're trying to add something here that I have not heard before, which is actually paying attention to how he did his work.
And, yes.
Right. And so you're bringing attention to the whole idea of the historical contingency of the social and technological process by which information is produced.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me a little bit about that. What are we saying?
Right. I'm arguing that, I guess I should back up and say that what I've found in learning about Kinsey and learning about lots of other sex researchers like William Masters and Virginia Johnson is that people are really, including me, are really interested in how their personal lives affect their research and affect their studies. I think, you know, the television program Masters of Sex is an excellent example of exactly that phenomenon. And what I found with Kinsey, previous literature on Kinsey, is that it really oversamples or overthinks his personal behavior at the expense of understanding the actual science involved in his work. And I think the four biographies that have been written about Kinsey and about the feature film and the PBS American Experience version of Kinsey's life are all very interested in explaining Kinsey's interests as part of a psychological, a psychological rebellion against his father. And I read all that literature and saw the movies, and I just thought, this may be true, but it's not what the record says. And so I wanted to kind of bring the science back into the sex research and argue that you can look at both the individual producing the work and the actual work processes and methods and outputs together.
So what do you think Kinsey, his long-term influence in terms of sex research after Kinsey, how did he influence what was done after him?
Yeah, he introduced using technology to study sexuality in a very, very clear way. Whereas one of his successors, William Masters and Virginia Johnson, they much more heavily used technology to study sex research. And of course, no sex research is done today without laboratories and in some cases MRI machines and other all kinds of measurement devices, let alone computers. And so he really introduces technology, and not just technology, but also an interest in mass studies of behavior. Of course, you know, Freud, you know, based his studies on just a, you know, maybe a small handful of individuals, maybe not even a dozen. And Jung also never used that as many individuals. So he also introduced the idea that you really needed to study a lot of people in order to get an idea of what most people were doing. And then just in terms of popular culture, his most clear legacy is that kind of figure of 10%, the idea that 10% of the American population is homosexual. And I would say, I should back up and say probably the number 10% and the 0 to 6 scale are both his most popular lasting legacies, because many, many people today still use the 0 to 6 scale as a way of thinking through their own sexuality and where they fall.
I think what it struck me really strongly about the book was how scientific practice, how science is done, has a great influence on values formation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think in terms of, you know, religion and other things providing values, but science here is very definitely forming, shaping, changing values.
Absolutely.
By the practice, about the what is studied, how it's studied, and what is how it's interpreted.
That is for sure. That I don't know. I mean, I think Kinsey is one of the. I once Googled the title "Father of the Sexual Revolution," and the two people who come up for that term, whose names are associated with that term most commonly, are Kinsey and Hugh Hefner. So, we could argue one way or the other for both of them, I imagine, despite the weirdness of the term "father of the sexual revolution." But I think, in a lot of ways, Kinsey really prefigures a dismantling, or at least a challenge to popular structures of religion, and replacing those structures with the power and authority of science. He got along with a lot of religious leaders, more than one might think, from all stripes of Christianity and Judaism. I don't know as much about if he was in contact with Muslim or other leaders, but really he is arguing for a world in which religion operates as a necessary restriction on people's freedom of sexual expression.
But what I was wondering too about, how does science, the way he's doing it, also in a way reinforce particular behavior? For instance, with big data that I brought up before, mm-hmm. Some people are doing big data studies on what's happening on dating sites. You've got mm-hmm. a huge mm-hmm. amount of data of people, who they're responding to, who's responding to them, what people are looking for, and they're finding, class prejudices and racial prejudices. And mm-hmm. and do we end up reinscribing that, reaffirming that in some way by collecting that data and how we interpret it, what it means?
I'm sorry, reinscribing like hierarchies?
If you look at big data of dating sites and uh-huh. you say, well, it looks to us like, majority of people will not date anybody who is not of their race.
Mm.
And by doing that, you kind of say you can naturalize it and say, well, that is natural. That's behavior. It's natural behavior to discriminate. Mm. Among race when you're dating. So in a way, you kind of reinforce it by saying it's natural. No?
I don't study the present as clearly as...
Right, but I understand that.
But I think the hard thing about Kinsey's data, and something that also Masters and Johnson come up against, is... what you're getting at with the describing dating sites is the nature of desire and how you decide that you desire somebody, or how you decide to love somebody, and what desire and love look like. And Kinsey says, I think somewhere in his marriage course lectures, that love is an emotion that people ascribe to physiological feelings of desire. And he's basically, one could say he was just sort of punting the question, because, in a lot of ways, I think that's what people are looking for when they're reading Kinsey, is, why am I attracted to these kind of people? Why do people do the kinds of behavior that they do? They really want to know what is the engine behind the behavior. But he was really not looking at that. He says something like, love is for poets and for philosophers and for, scholars of literature, or for literature writers and novelists. Love is not for science. For science can't address love. And so he leaves one of the great mysteries of human experience unexplored.
So he was not romantic.
Not in the research sense, no. But every indication is that he really loved his wife and his wife loved him and that they loved all of their children.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Maybe a little bit about Kinsey's ideas about gender.
Sure.
And one of my interesting findings was in the last five chapters of the female volume, he has five chapters that are not related to the kind of categorization of behavior, the masturbation and premarital intercourse and so on, but they're a way to sum up all of the data that he's found on animal and human anatomy, physiology, psychology, brain science, and hormonal science, endocrinology. And it's a radically different departure from the tenor of the male volume. And what he ends up finding is that men and women were very much alike in their anatomy and anatomy and their physiological sexual responses. They had some differences in hormones, but not as many as one might think, and that he really ended up thinking that if there's any such a concrete thing as gender difference, he didn't use the word gender, but if there was any difference between men and women, it was somewhere in the brain. It was somewhere in the brain, and he says where that difference is, we don't know. And in a way, it's this really telling moment buried deep 700 pages into the female volume where a scientist admits that he and his team do not know something and that they're they don't really admit defeat necessarily, but that they're willing to leave a major scientific question unanswered, really. And it was just really striking to think that even a scientist as incredibly well-read as Kinsey was, who gathered thousands and thousands of volumes and pamphlets and erotica materials and art and ephemera, couldn't pin down any specific difference about men and women. He sort of thought that there might be some gender difference in psychology. But again, it goes back to that interesting idea that he can only pin down gender difference in using a science that he usually despises. That you can't that if there's some kind of mystery to the the differences between men and women, it has to be in a science that he doesn't really like or understand. So I think there's this definite uneasiness about what the meaning of the difference between men and women is by the end of the female volume.
But when you brought up the whole issue that he said that he thought it was somewhere in the brain, that's very much where sex research, difference research is happening now. Is that not correct? The brain, the different brain between men and women's brains, and how is that affecting gender or how we see ourselves?
Absolutely. Yes, there's been a lot of studies recently using MRI machines and fMRI machines where people are given sexual images, or in the case of machines that capture motion, they're doing some kind of activity, and researchers are studying the relationship between the brain, the mind, and behavior. It's really fascinating.
So what do you hope that your book will do for the field? What do you think it's contributing, and what do you think it's hopeful that it will do in terms of the field of, yes, of science studies?
Yeah, I think my book is contributing both to gender and sexuality studies and history of sexuality and to the history of life and human sciences. And as far as the first goes, in terms of the field of gender and sexuality, I really hope to bring an understanding of Kinsey as a not just a kind of one-off scholar who just does the 0-6 scale and then moves on, but really had some fundamental contributions to the study of the scientific study of sexuality and gender. in the present, and that he should be taken seriously as a scholar and not just as as someone who films sex behavior in his attic, although that's part of it, to really think of him as a scientist. And in terms of the history of science, what I'd like to do is show kind of the fluidity of science as moving between the insect world, the plant world, the animal world, and the human world. The distinctions that a lot of historians of science ended up having to make between, you know, natural world and human world are not as clear in Kinsey's life, for sure, let alone his academic scholarship. So my work really shows the broadness of possibilities for the history of science.
I'm surprised this wasn't done before him, but I guess, like you said, he had to have the technology to do it. Mm-hmm. Because of evolutionary theory and putting humans on the you know, the scale of animals, you would think that this would have been sexual behavior would have been looked at closely before, outside of, you know, psychology.
It is to some degree by his predecessor, Robert Leto Dickinson, who did these extensive studies of his OBGYN patients. But the problem with doing sex research before Kinsey, and even, you know, through him and up until now, is that it is usually done by not just psychologists, but usually done by medical doctors. And medical doctors, you know, have an absolute, you know, authority in popular mind, popular culture, as the arbiters of what happens in the human body. But of course, they bring their own biases and prejudices to the study of the body and its behavior. And so what Kinsey does differently is he's not a physician, and he has to constantly tell people, I still have scientific authority, even though I'm not a physician. I just have a scientific authority coming from a different angle.
And he's also not looking for disease.
That's true. He's not looking to pathologize anybody. The only people he really pathologizes are those who have sex without consent. To some degree, he doesn't really emphasize rape all that much, but he is aware of it, of course. He pathologizes, he doesn't even pathologize really people who have sex with children, which is one of the big contemporary moral problems with his work. So he wants to put everybody under the umbrella of relative normalcy.
Okay, so you have been really generous with your time, and I have one final question for you. What are you working on now?
Right now, I'm working on a new project related to the history of the American women's health movement in the United States from the 1970s through the present. I was just at Duke University studying their materials from the Feminist Women's Healthcare Center in Atlanta, and I came across a cervical cap study that women's health centers across the country put forward to the FDA in the early 1980s. And they wanted to advocate for a specific kind of birth control that they felt women really responded well to using. Although the FDA didn't approve their request to make the cervical caps widely available, what this episode in history shows is that the kind of contrast in the views of science and technology between women's healthcare advocates and their patients and the federal government. Like, what kind of science is really the best for women? And that's what I'm working on right now.
Okay. Thank you, Donna, and to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. This is your host, Lillian Barger.